Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Welcome back to the Tailgate Podcast. I'm Terry Foy. He's Nick Osello. Nick, we are coming off the first full Saturday of college lacrosse. 31 games on Saturday and then a momentous one on Sunday. How you doing, my friend?
Bad is how I'm doing. So, my buddy was visiting, and not to be negative Nelly, but my car got broken into late last night. Had some stuff taken from it. And honestly, I was doing too good. 31 games to watch. You know, I was acting like I was 21 again. I was young. I had the world by the hand. I don't even know what the family-friendly appropriate analogy would be. I had the world in the palm of my hands, and then God just said, Nick, you're getting a little too cocky. You're having a little too much fun. Have a shattered window. But even then, even with that, Terry, credit to me for overcoming negativity. I'm happy as a clam. I'm going to deal with that. But imagine letting something like that ruin your entire day. Not going to be me. And I'm just ready to talk some lacrosse with my good friend, Terrence Foy.
Do you think that it was karmic retribution for Notre Dame winning the national championship on Saturday night?
No, I think what happens when Notre Dame actually wins a national championship this year,
it's going to lead to far more destruction.
Yeah. The reciprocation of that is going to be life altering. So
we'll quickly get through this so that I can ban you from talking about it. The Fighting Irish 24-2 over Detroit Mercy indoors. There's apparently another Kavanaugh. Chris, he's very good at lacrosse. The Kavanaughs themselves are very good.
Just let me know when I have the mic.
Go.
This is the best team that's ever set foot on a college lacrosse field. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. They would slap around every historically great team. Yes, the Kavanaughs are the talking point, but it's the goalies. It's the defense. It's the faceoff. It's the well-roundedness of this Notre Dame team that's going to take us to the promised land. No way this backfires. No way I wind up crying myself to sleep after a loss in the Final Four. This is the team that's going to carry us all the way. It should be illegal to play Detroit Mercy indoors because that was an embarrassment of a game. And honestly, I'm so excited that I'm just ready to get my heart ripped out again. Notre Dame lacrosse is Gonzaga basketball. My dad went there. We are having good expectations. And what do you think, like, honestly, Notre Dame, where would you rank them right now? One or two?
It's a good question. I am going to rank them number four.
And you're such a bias.
They're playing number three on Saturday, so maybe the winner of that? I don't know.
You know, this biased mainstream media putting Notre Dame at number four is disgusting. I have like 100 bits. I don't want to use all of them on the very first game. So just everybody hang on, because this is going to be a recurring theme over the next several months. But just know that I'm super high on Notre Dame, and we actually looked good. Like, I'm trying to be realistic about it, but my goodness, it was fun.
Yeah, proverbial wagon. You used the term historical greatness, so let me pick up on that as the segue to talk about the premier matchup of this weekend, which was the Maryland Terrapins heading up to the Carrier Dome, while Syracuse University honored Roy Simmons Jr. and Gary Gate. They retired Gary Gate's jersey, which is the number 22, because that's the number he wore. It is not the number 22, which is an important distinction. They put Roy Simmons Jr. in the Ring of Honor, and then prior to the women's game, they retired Katie Rowan's jersey, friend of Inside Lacrosse as well, so congratulations to her. But Logan Wisnoskis ruined the day, 4 goals and an assist. Tucker Dordovic really put the team on his back, he and Lucas Quinn. Dordovic had 5 goals and an assist. Looked like he was dealing with a little bit of a knock as well, so it made it even more impressive. Lucas Quinn had 3 goals. You know, the Terps were just mechanical in terms of their offense. The quality of looks they got relative to the quality of the looks that Syracuse got were night and day. Ryan Powell was talking about it extensively on the broadcast. And for me, you know, Jacob Faup had a better day at the Faceoff X than Luke Weirman did. And I think Logan McNaney had a slightly better day in net than Bobby Gavin did. But Bobby Gavin, San Diego native, played very well. For me, this one came down to the fact that Brett Makar put the clamps on Brendan Curry, and that's kind of – it's a little bit of where my concern about Syracuse stems from dating back to the preseason is that, you know, particularly without Owen Hiltz, who's done for a good while, if not the year, due to injury, who is the creator? And I think that when this team is humming, it's Curry, but when you can put – potentially one of the best defenders in the entire country on him. We're going to talk about a few guys in this podcast that can compete for that title in Makar, and he goes away. Well, then they become, I don't want to say easy to beat, but just a team that gets, that needs to get a lot out of Dorovic. And in this case, Lucas Quinn.
Well, and it's, you know, first off, Maryland is as advertised. My biggest complaint about, and just bear with me while I explain this analogy, is Maryland is kind of like Peyton Manning in the sense that I didn't think Peyton Manning was very fun to watch because it was so good and methodical and mechanical, where I was just like, he's going to drop back, he's going to throw it, it's going to be a 7-yard gain, and he's going to do that 100 times in a row.
There was nothing unpredictable about it.
Yeah, like Maryland is not like electric to watch because they're just that good. And in the same way that I was talking about Notre Dame just now, you know, it's tough to find a hole where, okay, you plug this hole on Maryland. Well, they're going to be able to beat you in 100 other ways. And I think that is the difference between a Maryland and a Syracuse. Like you just said, Syracuse has, you know, 10 Steph Currys on the team, but can you play with 6 finishers and not have an initiator? And we kind of found out, no. What I do like about the Syracuse team is I think that there are going to be ways to get a little bit creative, you know, attacking from attack versus midfield, doing some invert stuff. I think they found out pretty early on that if you're going to play an All-American defenseman or like one of the best in the country, you are going to have to get more creative. And the nice thing is that there are a ton of different ways to get creative, whether it's dodging from X, whether it's a 2-man game, whether it's a low wing. Like, you have good enough players to explore that a little bit. But until they find a way to get more creative, they're going to be limited to, you know, a semifinal team at best because you can't rely on one person the entire time.
So I want to make 2 points about coaching and then come back to Curry to build on a question that you just set up perfectly. So you have stated that you are very high on the Syracuse team because of Coach Gate.
Yes.
So I got to give credit to the resilience that this team showed in their spurt at the end of the second quarter to cut the halftime deficit to 1, and the same thing they did at the end of the third quarter. And for me, it's just the type of thing that a winning team shows, puts on film. That's like kind of the easiest way to put it. So I'm going to keep my eye on that. The second thing is the nature of the 3-man dynamic between Gary Gate, who literally had his jersey retired before the game, Dave Petromala, who is considered to be the best defensive player in like college lacrosse history, all apologies to Brody Merrill, and then Pat March, who I think deserved a lot of credit for the program's, you know, the success they were able to find over the course of the 2 years leading up to this past offseason. So point being that, like, Pat March is the offensive coordinator. I remember talking to John Desko and Kevin Donahue about how they approached coaching the team. One of them coached the man-to-man offense, and the other coached the zone offense. And I remember at the time I made the mistake in terms of identifying it, so I'm not going to try to get it right now because that was like 5 years ago. I'm just really interested in how the March Gate dynamic works, because I think the offense that you saw on Sunday was, it was supposed to be free-flowing, but it ended up just manifesting in a lot of one-on-one dodges, a lot of isolation, and a lot of off-ball movement that the guy with the ball in his stick wasn't able to predict where his teammates were going to go. And as a result, like, it didn't yield good shots. I mean, and this is weird in the way that kind of like a positive can prove a negative, but I have this one very clear memory of a pass down from the top of the box to an open man on the goalpost. And it was kind of like the only easy goal that Syracuse really scored today. And I'm just fascinated by how they're going to try to create some type of system that is a melding of Gary Gate and Pat Marsh in a way that's similar to what John Grant Jr. talked about on the podcast with Matt Bachlett and Pete Poyon last week, where he was like, you know, Pete Milliman's got his system. He was really successful at Cornell. I'm not going to come in and try to reinvent it, but at the same time, I am going to put my own mark on it. And now we've got this, you know, Gate Marsh dynamic that are just really interested to see how it comes to fruition.
I am too. And first off, I thought of a joke where it's like, oh, you know, you can never actually judge how good Syracuse is when they have a historical night because Notre Dame slapped them around.
The 17-7 game?
Yeah. So, you know, I think if Syracuse wants to win, they shouldn't retire a jersey. They shouldn't do anything like that. But in the, you know, I think it's interesting. I believe we touched on it last podcast where Junior, the coach, has so much to offer, but he needs it to make sense on a player that doesn't have Junior's skill set.
Yeah.
And I'm extremely curious how, you know, Gate's going to do that with, hey, you can drop a play that works for you, but you're literally one of the best of all time. Like, that is not going to work for anybody on the field. So I think he has the advantage of, like, you know, having obviously an incredible box background, field background. Like, he can draw from a lot of different places just like Junior can. But I might text a couple Syracuse guys and just ask, like, hey, are the plays he draws up so over the top that you have no idea what the hell's going on? Or is it something that you can, like, kind of quickly and easily understand? So, again, something to keep an eye on, but I am very bullish still on this Syracuse team, and I think they're going to figure it out and be a Final Four team.
All right, last one on this game before we move on. How do you describe yourself as a player? Were you a two-way midfielder?
God, you're going to get me talking about myself after a long day. I don't know. How cocky should I be right now?
Well, okay. It might not actually matter. So let me just get my question out, and then you can draw on your own experience if it's pertinent.
Thank you.
So in an era when the distinction between attackmen and midfielders seems less relevant than ever before, increasingly less relevant every year. To me, I look at Brendan Curry's game, and even though he is a good alley dodger, the way, like, and he is, I can understand how he's the type of guy that needs his speed and as a result needs a lot of space, like 20, 25 yard runs in order to be able to make something happen. I just look at how upright he is when he dodges, his stick protection, which I think is very, very high, his two-handedness, and the fact that he's kind of a pass-first player, and I just say to myself, like, that guy's an attackman. And so when they move Dordovic from midfield to attack, I kind of scratch my head. Like, I understand the idea that you just want to have your best player on the field as much as possible, but why not do it with both of them?
I agree, and, you know, it's one of those things that I need to get better at this, because every single time, like, we talk about something like this, I could talk about the 15 different factors. Like, who are the other players on the field? Who are you playing against? Like, you know, but I would say the overarching thing is you need to have people that are willing to be, you know, supportive of an initiator. And I think that when he has a dynamic ability and when he's a feed first guy, it doesn't make a lot of sense to have him as midfield. And maybe that's just the classic Kevin Corrigan, initiate from attack and then have the attack move it to a guy like Sergio Perkovic who shoots a piss missile. But I still think there is credence to, like, listen, if you have a guy that is going to be good, you want him at attack more than midfield, because they're also, you know, keep in mind over the course of a game, in that fourth quarter, like, if your game plan is to wear him out and keep him on the field, like, that fourth quarter, he's not going to be nearly as dynamic. So I could answer it in 100 different ways, but the line between attack and midfield has gotten much blurrier even since I, you know, had been playing college. But if you have a guy like that, I'm on the side that he needs to be an attackman, and that will reap the benefits, you know, way more over the course of a game and a season than trying to have him be midfield because he needs a longer run, because he can get caught on defense, because, you know, if he's feeding, you know, it might be to another distributor. So I don't know. I'm kind of rambling right now, but just put him on attack. If you have a good offensive player, put them at attack before midfield. End rant.
Syracuse could go 0-14, and I would still give them a top 20 vote because they put names on the back of their jerseys, and that is one of my big passion points. All right, moving on.
And they're in the ACC, and aside from UNC, ACC is top five.
Georgetown 10, Penn 8. This was arguably the most anticipated game of Saturday afternoon. It's an interesting game in kind of the way that I think it puts a tweet that I sent on Saturday morning, not to kind of make it that like bald-faced, into pretty clear distinction, but I'll get to that at the end of this summary. TJ Haley returned from injury after not having played against Johns Hopkins in the Hoyas opener. He was blanked. It looks like he's making his way back. Graham Bundy had 2 goals and 2 assists. Connor Morin, Bundy, by the way, was back in midfield. Morin had 2 goals and assists. And once again, the Hoyas got an important contribution from their transition. Zach Geddes, the short 60 midi, and James Riley, the faceoff guy, both scored goals. For the Quakers, Dylan Gergar had 4 goals. Cam Rubin had 2 goals and an assist. And, you know, this game really in large part came down to the job that Will Bowen, the North Carolina grad transfer for Georgetown, did on Sam Hanley, limiting him to 1 goal and 2 assists. Hanley had a pass on Emo that was, when he was playing point, that was to a step down, or it was a top down pass that was just perfect through all 5 defenders. Easily caught on the doorstep for a finish that just illustrated why I am so fond of his game. You know, he's a player who was a first-team All-American midfielder as a freshman in 2019, who is now nominally an attackman, or not nominally, he's practically an attackman. But, you know, for me, there were a lot of games on Saturday that looked like NCAA tournament games. There were 6 top 20 matchups. This is one, I think a lot of them looked like first round matchups. We're going to talk about a bunch of them. This is the one that looked like a quarterfinal or a semifinal matchup for me. And, you know, I didn't watch it as closely as I'll probably rewatch it this week, but Matt Kinnear was there, so I had my focus elsewhere because he kind of had it under control. And, but all that being said, like for me, this game kind of, I don't want to oversimplify it, but it was a team that had played a game versus a team that hadn't. And the tweet that I sent is, how do you compare the advantage of having played a game to having scouted on your opponent? We talked about this with Patrick Daly last week, and I think that, you know, whether it was some of the sloppiness, some of the mistakes, some of the, and Penn coach Mike Murphy talked about this after the game, it felt like they were taken out of their game because of they fell behind. And I think those are the types of things that the experiences that you derive from having just one game under your belt, the comfort that comes from that, that, you know, I think is really significant. And 82% of my Twitter followers who voted thought that having a game under your belt was more valuable than playing a team that you didn't have a scouting report on.
I completely agree. There's a lot to touch on there. First thing I would like to say is I'm just excited to see how the Ivy League pans out, because this has me very bullish on the Ivies in general, because Georgetown, you know, top 5 team, everyone's talking about them being incredible, and for Penn to make it a 2-goal game, I thought said more about Penn potentially than it did about Georgetown. And the second thing, I think it's the difference between good and great. And there's that super cliche saying where it's like good is the enemy of great, because when I was an idiot, which I still am to this day, but when I was an idiot about preparing for games, right, it was the classic coach speak of just focus on your game, worry about yourself. We play the way that we play, but that's stupid. Like if you have a scout on a team and you can figure out how you're going to address that, that's the biggest advantage you could possibly have. Like the biggest difference between high school and college across is the amount of time you spend in the film room. Like
that's a great point.
Yeah, and everyone's like, oh, what can I do to prepare for college across? I'm like, watch film. They're like, no, like workout wise. And I'm like, no. Watch film with a purpose. So I think it's a huge green light that, you know, when you have the opportunity to watch film and the other coach after the game says, we just kind of couldn't get into our rhythm, we couldn't get into our game. Huh. Well, that shows me that you have a group of players that's doing things the right way in the film room. And that's such a differentiating factor. So, you know, again, I'm pumped to see the Ivies playing again. I love seeing an Ivy League game, show up on the Inside Lacrosse dashboard. Good plug.
Yeah, but, we needed it. Had the biggest day in website history yesterday. Thanks for your plug, Nick.
Yeah. All credit to me. But I just love a team that can, you can kind of draw some things out early in the season. And for them to, for them to actually be in the film room with this much diligence early on, I think the quote by the coach said it all. So that's my nerd analysis, is good on them for getting in the film room and making that the deciding factor in the game.
Ohio State 20, North Carolina 8. I don't remember the last time I was this surprised by an outcome of a game. And truthfully, this was a later in the afternoon start. So I was, cleaning up some other type of work that I'd been doing over the course of the day and, was kind of watching out of the corner of my eye for the first half. And it was going more or less the way I expected. That's not even true. I was really impressed that Ohio State was able to keep it close. And then the third quarter, oh my God, I think Ohio State went on an 8-0 run. At one point, they had 10 goals from 10 different scorers. They scored a ton in transition. Jack Myers finished the game with 7 assists. I had him on in the fall, and he talked about how being challenged by Bobby Van Buren was really helping his game over the course of the fall. And I don't know if that yielded the 7-assist game, but what a facilitating day he had. Still, despite only having 8 goals, Chris Gray notched 7 points. And the last thing I'll say is, gotta feel good to be Caden Johnson. You started at North Carolina. You looked like the answer in net. Got beaten out by Colin Krieg. Transferred to Ohio State. Head back to Chapel Hill. Get the win. And I'll play your counterpart.
It's interesting because I was watching that game or the end of the game with Trey LeClaire, Ohio State Buckeye, very quiet, very not as good at lacrosse as I was, but that's neither here nor there. And so my idiot take is that UNC doesn't count as an ACC team and that they're losers. I don't like them. I never liked playing against them, and I would be happy to publicly trash them outside of Joey Sankey, who's a great guy. So I had my whole entire spin zone, but to actually comment on it, I actually was thinking about this. When was the last time you were this surprised by a game? I honestly can't really make the distinction. I've never been more surprised by a game because
I've got one for you.
What do you got?
When you guys shut out Ohio State.
I mean, listen, 2015, there I was. No. shutouts are rare, classic, but 20-8 is like so over the top comical. It's like, name a game that would be 20-8. I would have said, okay, that'd be Notre Dame, Detroit. That'd be Syracuse, Holy Cross. So I'm going to use this for two ways. One, I'm going to put Ohio State as the only good team from the Big Ten, besides Maryland, of course, because I've been very critical of Maryland, Hopkins, Rutgers, and, all those teams that are in the Big Ten that everybody thinks, get screwed out of a tournament spot when they don't deserve it. So I'm officially saying that Maryland and Ohio State are good, and I'm officially saying that UNC is the basement floor dump of the ACC. And if we want to return to the greatness and the prestige that we normally are accustomed to, they need to get their stuff together. So I think I'm kind of doing it in both ways. I think Ohio State's going to make a big run, and I think UNC is going to potentially miss the tournament because they're just not a very good organization.
Turns out that having some experience at the midfield is very important, and let me take that opportunity to say that St. Ignatius High School in Cleveland, Ohio is turning into D-Mitty High School, as it's not just Connor Camille, ladies and gentlemen, but Greg Langermeyer, who tore his ACL the first game of his junior year of high school, and as a result was not recruited, walked on to the Ohio State Buckeyes, scored a goal in their first game, which I believe was also against Detroit, and then scored a big goal in transition in Chapel Hill. So I don't know if they're their number one and number two short sticks, but I think they are number 8 and number 34. Keep an eye on those guys. They are
animals. Is there a coach? Because I know St. Ignatius and St. Xavier and all these Ohio schools mixed up.
Yeah, no, probably know the St. Xavier folks better than the St. Ignatius folks, but Mason Weinacher is the coach. Joe Bame, Mike Bame's older brother, is the assistant. They got a bunch of other assistants as well. But that's where I went, in case I didn't make that clear.
No, you got it.
Speaking of where I went.
I'm so biased, it's a joke. Because I see a D. Mitty from Ohio, and I'm like, he might be the best player of all time. Like, anyone who's not from Baltimore or Long Island and makes one play, I'm like, he should probably be like honorable mention at least.
Yeah.
So I love looking at box scores and then like looking up what high schools people are from. So credit to Ohio State for having a deep roster. I'll spare the gossip, but I've heard good or bad, like a polarizing figure about Coach Myers. You know, you either love him or hate him. And, you know, I think that's an interesting thing is like if you can be hated as a coach, you're probably, you know, running a tight ship. But if somebody out there loves you and you're doing the right thing, then you're probably doing some things right. And there's a spectrum and there's nuance. And if there's one thing I hate in this world, it's nuance. But for him to come out, it's like it's putting me more firmly on the side of he's doing things right. And anyone who's like, oh, my God, Coach Myers was like, he made us run so much after a game. It's like, well, then, A, you probably shouldn't have lost it. And B, look what he just did to UNC. Good for him. So I'm not a pro Nick Myers fan, but I will say you kick UNC's ass like that. That's a hell of a place to start.
No doubt. Speaking of places that I went, Johns Hopkins University 11, Loyola College Greyhounds 10. Did you see any of this? Specifically, did you see the play that Hopkins ran with 1 minute and 1 second left on the clock, up 11 to 10, having just had a beautiful short stick, backside double that should have been the game-clinching play? They clear, call timeout. Coming out of the timeout, Loyola is doubling. Connor DeSimone has the ball. Loyola's goalie is covering whoever the nearest Johns Hopkins offensive player is, but he's on the far side of him. And DeSimone throws the ball toward the end line before even trying to split the double. Like, whistle blows. Like, this was clearly something that was organized. And Loyola goalie just easily picks up the ground ball, and they clear, and they get another opportunity. It was one of the wildest things I've seen. And the redemption of the Johns Hopkins defense to get another stop and prevent a game-tying goal. Blake Rogers, shout out, unbelievable play down the stretch in order to make that happen. Was incredible. But, yeah, do you know what I'm talking about? Have you seen this?
I did see the end of the play. So a lot of, like, little behind the curtain scenes. What I do to prepare is obviously look at all the box scores. You know, I'll watch a couple games in real time, but I'll just like try to find like all the clips. This was one of the clips where I was like, huh, I can't remember if everybody in college is the stupidest person of all time or if I'm just a genius now. What's like, can you walk me through what they were trying to do? Because I was just getting angry about it. Like, what would you have done?
The answer to the question is no.
Damn it.
I probably should have sent a few texts this afternoon when I was writing this rundown to try to come up with a better answer. So I apologize to you, the listener, for all this free content that you're getting that is not up to my own personal standards. That being said,
that's what puts the asses in the seats, though. This is the good stuff.
The incompetence?
Yes.
So I assume they're just trying to create a ground ball scrum and believe in their ability to come up with it. I mean, so we were talking about it on the Inside Lacrosse chat during the game. And, like, there's so much to this. Like, I've talked to coaches who just don't believe you should ever go behind the goal when you're trying to kill the clock. Because the ability to throw the ball at the net, either for a shot that goes out of bounds and then you can back up and that the ref gives back to you, or to actually go into the net, particularly when it's empty, is a valuable way to combat the fact that you're 6-on-7, right? You're down a man. And once you go behind the net, not only are you – I mean, the counter idea is that obviously you want to get as far away from your own goal as possible – but, yeah, I mean, it was – like, because we were talking about it, should he have tried to throw the ball just, like, right in front of the goal? Now, obviously, offensive players can't go into the crease, so you don't want the ball to go into the crease. I guess I mean, the normal conventional idea is just give the ball to your best athlete, have him try to split the double or run away from the double, and, you know, see what unfolds from there. But crazy sequence. I don't know whether it was a coach-dictated decision or a player-dictated decision. That's probably the most important thing. And then I would assume that regardless, but especially if it were a player-dictated decision, just didn't go the way that it was supposed to go. They, you know, didn't execute it the way that they wanted to.
Yeah, and again, drawing, you know, seeing 1 inch and taking a mile is another one of my favorite things. So, like, for them to have that happen, whether it's on the players or whether it's on the coaches, I'm like ready to, you know, throw out major red flag alert, fraud alert, all that good stuff. I'm still having a tough time. Where on the good scale is Hopkins and Loyola? Because Loyola got absolutely smoked by Maryland, who played Cuse relatively close. And now it's a 10-11 game. Are you thinking that these two teams are frauds, or are you thinking that they're, you know, probably like in the, what, like 11 to 16 range? Where do you rank Hopkins and Loyola? Because a close game was not what I was expecting. I was expecting one team to kind of separate themselves from the other.
So, as usual, I'm going to provide you with your favorite thing, which is nuance.
I've got three points. Just fire from the hip.
Hopkins, I think, is 11. Loyola is like between 20 and 22, which is too wide of a gap for a team that just played, or two teams that played a one goal game. But Hopkins doesn't have a loss like Loyola's Maryland loss. So
that illustrates Loyola's floor being lower to me. For most of the game, though. I mean,
yeah, no, and I think it was interesting because I actually, when I was watching this game, thought that Loyola was outplaying Hopkins and they were just losing in the goal and they were losing at the faceoff X. And then it went back. Bailey Savio really got things on track in the second half, and they actually ended up winning more faceoffs than Hopkins did. They didn't get good goaltending. Hopkins, once again, got solid goaltending out of Josh Curson. But Loyola was 10 of 41 in terms of their offensive efficiency. Hopkins was 11 of 30. So I look at it, and I come away. The biggest takeaway for me is that Hopkins played poorly and won, which I think is like essential for any good team. And it's particularly essential for any team that's trying to go from mediocre to good or bad to good, depending on how bad or mediocre you think they were last year. If you can play poorly and win, particularly against another mediocre to good team, that's a skill that has a lot of value. So I actually feel better about both teams coming away from this game. Loyola for their ability to demonstrate a little bit more of their own identity, particularly their ability to score in transition. And then Hopkins for their ability to win a game when they play poorly.
Yeah, I mean, I just get so mad when you start talking about nuance and you bring like a rational opinion and a well thought out that I can't just immediately talk a bunch of smack to. So I don't know. I have Hopkins at like, you know, closer to 15 and Loyola closer to 25, if that helps.
Yes.
I'm putting them a little bit lower, maybe keeping them humble, giving them some bulletin board material and going from there. And I think that could be true,
but in order for it to be true, a lot of these teams who are 2-0 or 3-0 and haven't played anybody yet, you need to think are better than Hopkins and Loyola, and that's fine. But that's why they play the games. We're going to find out. It is crazy to me that we are this far into the podcast and we haven't talked about Duke 19, Denver 10. I mean, this is a matchup that's been the premier matchup of this weekend many, many years prior. Hey, remember last week when Duke lost to Jacksonville?
A tale as old as time. Duke loses to Jacksonville, and if I didn't take my gambling integrity training so seriously, I would have hammered their future to win the national championship. And it's, I don't know, you can only have the same take so many weeks in a row, but Duke losing, and now they look like a wagon against a Denver team that
might not be that good.
I'm not going to rush any conclusions on Denver because they played Utah close, and I think Utah's sneaky good, blah, blah, blah. Not going down the rabbit hole. I have Duke as like, you know, top three team, especially coming off of that Jacksonville loss. They look unstoppable. They look like, you know, and tell me this. So Maryland is like Peyton Manning in the sense that it's almost not fun to watch. Why does Duke have so many more big name people? Is that just because it's Duke lacrosse, or am I actually watching Nakai and O'Neal and the rest of the offense light up a very good Denver team and think that they're better than any offense in the country besides Notre Dame?
I think you got to answer that question by broadening it out more than just this year. Nope. You got to talk about it in the context of like 10 years. But I think it's true. Like, you know, why does it feel like, you know, the Twerton finalists or the Twerton winners from Duke are more famous than the equivalent players from Maryland, right? Like, why is Miles Jones so much more famous than Mike Chanchuk?
Has a real chance to win the Twerton, but someone says Wisnaukas, and I'm like, oh, you know, I'm not sold. Like, why does my brain be an idiot like that? I don't know. But
we know it's the reason that you explained from the top. I mean, it is the mechanical like nature of John Tillman teams. At least that's my opinion. I mean, I'm sure there's more to it than that. And I guess the better question is, like, how do you explain, are Matt Rambeau and Jared Bernhardt outliers in this conversation? Because, like, I don't even really think they are. Like, Jared Bernhardt probably got more famous after playing football for Ferris State than he did winning the Twerton for Maryland. You know what I mean? Like, within the lacrosse community.
I completely agree. Like, and if Jared Bernhardt played for Duke, I would have been like, holy smokes, this is the second coming of Jesus.
It's the future of lacrosse.
Yeah. I was kind of in like a sneaky big argument. Granted, it was, you know, we'll say fueled by ulterior motives.
Is that an SAT word for trolling?
I don't know, trolling or just drunk rambling, you decide. But I was like, no, Duke has the best players. And my counterparty was like, it's not that. It's just the fact that they're Duke. It's like the Yankees win the pinstripes. You know, the Yankees win because they wear the pinstripes. And I'm like, well, good, then they should. So all that to say, you know, to try and stay on topic here, I am very bullish on Duke. And I'm ready to put Denver on fraud watch because Utah, they beat Vermont by one, right?
Yeah.
Close game. I don't know how good Vermont is. I think Denver's...
Vermont beat Penn State on Wednesday.
Yeah, but Penn State's a dumpster fire, which we'll talk about in 1 second here. I don't know. I just think Duke's going to tap dance their way to the national championship after their classic and patented February loss, and Denver isn't as good as people think. And they have like that unique style of offense where it's like a bunch of Canadians, which can be impossible to play against. And they have like upset factor, but they don't have deep run factor. Like, I don't think they're going to win the national championship at all, but they might upset a Maryland, or they will never upset a Notre Dame in the playoffs. That's not in their blood. You know, they could take down a big team. I don't think they have the longevity is my take on Denver so far.
So just really quick on Duke, this game hinged in the beginning of the third quarter when they carried a 9-6 lead into halftime and turned it into a 12-6 lead with 12:30 to go in the third quarter. Nakai had a goal and an assist in that stretch. O'Neal had a goal and an assist. Joe Robertson had a goal. All three goals were in transition. It was just like, if they're going to play like this, they're going to be very, very hard to beat. And from that game, or from that point on, it felt academic.
Yeah, all right. Like the opposite of Syracuse. It's like, oh, Syracuse has like kind of one dimension. Duke is like a six-dimensional threat, and it's BS. Correct. I hate it.
Yeah, and they're still going to move Sean Lilly to attack, and he's going to put up 45 assists in the last 10 games. It's going to be incredible. Mm-hmm. Yale 17, Nova 14. We're going to talk about this one briefly just because I had my eye on it. I was watching it pretty closely, wrote an article about it. You know, I have Yale higher than most people do. I think they're 7 in the poll. I think I have them 5. I think they're really good. I saw exactly what I expected to see from this team. It was funny. I was talking to Andy Shea. I was interviewing him after the game, and I brought up Brandow after we had talked about pretty much every other player. And he was like, what do you have? And I was like, 5-1. And he's like, oof, whoa, or wow. Like he, and I was like, yeah, no, I feel the same way. Like it didn't feel like he was imposing his will on the game until the fourth quarter. Like, I don't think he took back-to-back shots until, you know, late. And he was just like, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the type of player he is. Like, you know, he's a facilitator. He's not going to try to get his own until getting his own is what's necessary in order to win. But at the same time, so Nova scored early. Yale at one point was leading 6-1. All of a sudden, Nova was leading 9-8 at halftime. They had a really nice day offensively, where that Penn State game really kind of felt like the Pat Daly show. It really felt like Luke Keating and Matt Campbell contributed a lot to the Villanova offense. And then at the other end of the field, you know, I thought, first of all, Jack Stuzan, he's a sophomore, but he's really a freshman. Class 2020, hadn't played yet. I think he was our number one, or I think he was our top ranked defender in his class. He had 5 cost turnovers, so advice to ball carriers, don't carry the ball around him in the future. And Leo Johnson had 3 goals. He is a lefty freshman that just looks really comfortable and slick. So, you know, it's gonna take a lot, right, in order to get better. You know, they didn't play Penn, but they probably had the second best opponent of any Ivy League team. And as a result, like, they just had to work for the win. They had to learn how to win, which is what happens when you've got like 40 guys on your team that have never really contributed to winning a college lacrosse game before. So, you know, I leave feeling almost exactly the way about Yale as I felt going in. And I think Villanova is like, I'm going to have him number 20. I think they're right there on the cusp of being a top 20 team. And, you know, they kept this to a 3-goal game, but there were points during the game where it felt like it had a potential to be a little bit more one-sided in the Bulldogs' favor.
So I just have one quick follow-up question in the notes in preparation for this podcast, because we grind, we work hard, we do our due diligence. You said there's a quiet 5-1. Can you just describe what a quiet 5-goal performance looks like? Because I've never seen that before in my life.
Yeah, it's when you ask his coach, or when you ask his coach how he played, and he asks you what he produced, and you tell him, and he is surprised. So it's the type of game. I don't think you can score like more than 2 goals in succession. But I guess also like when a team scores 17 goals and one guy only has 5 of them, like, yeah, I mean, as long as he's not doing it on the same defensive player the whole time, if he's doing it through switches or man up or whatever, and then nobody's like taking responsibility for it, like individually, and his teammates aren't looking at him like, hey man, you have to figure this out, because otherwise we're getting roasted and it's going to be a long bus trip home. I think that is a quiet 5-1.
Fair. I just, you know, anytime someone has 3, it's like, okay, he's got the hot hand, you know, pay attention to him. So anytime I see quiet 5-1, I just need a little extra context for it. What about Yale was sloppy? Like, what does Yale need to do to clean it up? Is it between the lines? Is it defense? Is it offense? What's, like, just give me a little on that.
Yeah, so they failed a bunch of clears. And if you want to look at all the bad stuff they did, just watch the second quarter. And I don't think they did, like, they threw the ball out of bounds. I don't know if they did it more than, like, twice. They threw the ball to the opposing team. I don't think they did any one thing like every single time. They struggled to win faceoffs in the second quarter. It was weird. Like, it was also, and Dan Kaplan and I were talking about this during the game. He was just like, I took the dog out. It was 6-2. Now it's 7-6 Yale. Like, what happened? And it kind of felt like that watching it too. It was like, you know, incremental, like, Villanova got a goal here or whatever. So I think the combination of they lost a couple faceoffs that they had won in the first quarter, they threw the ball out of bounds a couple times, they threw the ball to Villanova a couple times, I think they shot and it just hit a Villanova defender once, and then Villanova came with the ground ball. So, you know, it was just like a combination of all the things that if you only do it once, you can live with it. But when you do each of them twice and it results in like 8 possessions going the other way, that's, I think, what happened.
Got it. Yeah, this is the one game that I feel like I shouldn't comment on because I only watched, you know, briefly skim the highlights. But I think Nova sneaky is better than people are giving them credit for. I know that you just mentioned you have them on 20, but Yale is kind of a wagon. And they have for years, and people are hyping them up. It seems to be business as usual, where they're just kind of going and, you know, classic Josai paying for what looked like, from some pictures that I saw, the sickest facility I've ever seen that's strictly lacrosse. So I love watching a team like Nova lose by, you know, what is it, 3, lose by 3 goals, and still think that that's like a huge win in their book. So good for Nova. I'm gonna keep an eye on them and hesitate just a little bit when I talk smack about them.
We're going to talk about snow real quick. There was an unbelievable whiteout.
Awesome. Go ahead.
There was an unbelievable whiteout in Boston U's win over Bryant. And your boys, the Merrimack Warriors, 8-6 victors over Dartmouth. I believe that game was in Hanover, and it was played in like 5 inches of snow.
And everybody rushes to make the same joke. I thought it was a spring sport. Ha ha, it's snowing. Yeah, shut up. That joke's over. But that clip of in 40 seconds going from a relatively decent looking game to complete whiteout, that's one of my favorite things. And whether you win or lose that game, every time I see that, I almost stop caring about what's happening on the field, because I know that 10 years down the line, they're going to be talking about, dude, do you remember that crazy snowstorm? Like, there would never be a reason to be outside for that other than sports. And for them to have to play through that is so much damn fun that I almost caught myself being jealous of them, knowing that the winning team is going to, you know, turn all the hot water on in the showers and, like, scream and yell and just, like, we beat Mother Nature and, you know, whoever we were playing. Because we had a game like that in Ohio State where I couldn't believe how hard it was snowing. You know, I grew up in Denver and I'd seen snowstorms. I'd never seen that. We're still talking about it 10 years down the line. So I see that. I don't even care about lacrosse. I don't care who's playing. Good for those kids to, like, play in a historic viral snowstorm. Who cares if you lost? You're going to be talking about that one for years over a beer, you know, 10 years down the line. So good for them.
All right. Four games that I haven't been able to watch but deserve mention. Rutgers 13, Army 10. Rutgers gets a top 10 victory. UMBC 12, Drexel 8. The first game for both teams. The Retrievers touted defense holds defending CA champions to 8 goals. I believe that game was played in Catonsville. Hobart 14, Lehigh 13. This, you know, was, it was interesting. We were talking about it. Like, if you go 50% at the faceoff X, it's unlikely that you're going to get touted. But if you do it against Mike Sisselberger, you're probably going to get some nice kudos, and that is exactly what the Hobart faceoff specialist did. I was looking up his name, and it just says Hobart faceoff guy. Thanks a lot, Matt Kinnear, in your Slack message to me. Oh, mercy. And I think it's Adam Shea. It is Adam Shea. 14-27. Great job against Sisselberger. And then a game that I know you're excited to talk about, St. Joe's 15, Penn State 13. You've got the floor, Nick.
Yeah, so I don't want to come off as rude, and, you know, all these,
you never would.
Yeah. I would never do that. They're college kids. They're trying their best. Penn State's a dump. Cancel the program. Get it off of my TV screen. Get it off of the scoreboard. I'm so sick of seeing Happy Valley, more like Loser Valley. You guys are losers. I hate you. I hate Penn State. Congrats to intern Kulin Reich on St. Joe's 15-13. I don't think Penn State's going to win another game this year, let alone the rest of the decade, potentially. And now that I got that out of my system, you know.
Turns out Mac O'Keefe was pretty good at lacrosse. Do you know him?
Yeah, I shove him in a locker on a daily basis. So fun fact about Mac O'Keefe, I tried to do a podcast with him last week. I think it needs to be sponsored by Calm or Headspace to say, like, hey, if you're struggling to fall asleep, listen to this podcast with Mac O'Keefe. He's a great guy, and then you put a camera or a microphone in front of him, and he becomes Control-C, Control-V, copy-paste, generic white guy. But I love him. Great guy. You know, it's just a shame that he had to go to Penn State and set the all-time record for a complete loser organization. But again, we're not here to attack, and I would never slum, you know, to personal attacks on any specific program. The other take is, congrats, Rutgers, you beat Army. What do you hate, America? Grow up. You guys aren't going to win the national championship. Stop talking like you're a contender, because you're not. Know your role. You're in New Jersey. No one lives in New Jersey on purpose. It's because you didn't get into Notre Dame is why you're at Rutgers in the first place. But I would never.
No, the reason you live in New Jersey is
because
you don't want to pay New York State taxes.
Yeah. Listen, you know, New Jersey could just be one big tax scheme to get outside of New York. So anyways, but I'm not here to attack. Do you have any takes on those four games? Because I kind of said my piece.
No, I didn't realize that Colin scored. Congrats to him.
Yeah. Congrats, Coolin.
Nick, that'll do it for the tailgate. Now we got to go start drinking.
Boy, was I hanging on by a thread this entire time. So thank you for your patience, and I love you, Terry.
You did a great job, buddy.
Say it back.
I love you too.
Oh, let's go. All right, now I can enjoy my Sunday.
Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.